Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What we have here is an economic conundrum. We learned this morning gross domestic product grew at a 3.4% clip last quarter, healthy by most standards. And yet the Dow Industrials have given up 519 points in the last 2 days. We know the stock market's not the economy, but clearly there's some kind of disconnect going on here. Or is there? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, representing America's public transportation industry, delivering 10 billion riders annually, and working for an energy-independent America. PublicTransportation.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 27th of July. Good to have you here. Nothing macroeconomic changed between 4 yesterday afternoon in New York and 8:30 this morning in Washington. But the two numbers that were posted at those hours, they give you some pause. 311 points down on the Dow yesterday. Gross domestic product up almost 3.5% this morning. Yes, the GDP number is what's called a lagging indicator. That is, it tells you what's already happened. But still, somehow, you'd have thought it would drive investors up today, not down. Instead, the Dow gave up another 200 points, as Marketplace's Steve Henn explains, or at least tries to.
Okay, first, let's start with the good news.
The economy is recovering.
Peter Morici is a professor of economics at the University of Maryland. He says in the first 3 months of 2007, the U.S. economy was a hair's breadth away from recession. But this spring, it turned around.
In the second quarter, business investment bounced back. A cheaper dollar against the euro helped exports, and government spending picked up a bit. Overall, it was a very positive report.
Consumer spending was down a bit, easing inflation worries at the Fed. So what are the markets so worried about?
I think the stock market is overly focused on the subprime crisis.
Many of the banks, brokerages, and institutional investors that bought big blocks of risky adjustable-rate mortgages have been burned.
You can just imagine what they're saying to themselves right now. Let's not do that again.
Hugh Johnson, chief economist at Johnson Illington Advisors, says that means all kinds of debt finance deals, like the proposed buyout of Chrysler by Cerberus, are suddenly receiving a lot more scrutiny than they were just a few months ago. Johnson says it was those kinds of buyouts that helped fuel the huge gains on Wall Street this year. Now, the future of many of those deals seems uncertain.
Well, yeah, the riskier loans, the riskier buyouts, the more leveraged, riskier buyouts aren't going to get done. And you know, that's healthy.
But it also seems to have cut the legs out from under the run-up in stock prices, at least for now. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The buzz on Wall Street until this week, anyway, has been private equity. And the hottest private equity group out there has been Blackstone. It was hard to miss all the hype when Blackstone started selling shares a month ago. Mention it to investors today, and you'll get nothing but dirty looks. Blackstone's turned out to be one of the weakest IPOs of the year, which is forcing other private equity firms to have second thoughts about going public. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
Since its debut on the New York Stock Exchange last June, shares in Blackstone have fallen 21% from their initial asking price. Today it had its lowest closing price yet.
So far it's been a rough ride. Shares advanced modestly, I think you'd say, on the first day of trading, and they've drifted downward pretty steadily since then.
That's Morningstar analyst Jeff Patak. He says private equity firms have gotten rich by being opportunistic, and they bring that same approach to the stock market. What does that mean for the individual investor?
You're paying a heck of a lot of money for an excellent business, but maybe too much money to recoup the full worth of your investment. And so I think that the phrase buyer beware is well warranted.
Three private equity firms have gone public in recent months, and each has performed poorly. For example, Fortress Investment Group shares are down nearly 50%. David Menlow is president of the research firm IPOfinancial.com. He says the track record isn't encouraging for Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, another private equity firm planning to go public in the next few months. Menlow says the company should hold off.
I would advise them to hit the exit door, pull the offering, and go back to the drawing board and wait for another leg up in the marketplace.
Some financial commentators have playfully suggested that going public has made Blackstone vulnerable. After all, private equity firms specialize in recognizing undervalued companies and taking them over. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Investors tried today but just couldn't bounce back. We'll have the details in the whole wild week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. Former Quest CEO Joseph Nocio had his day in court today. It cost him $71 million in fines and restitution and 6 years in jail. Nocio was convicted of insider trading back in April, part of a $3 billion accounting scandal at the telecommunications company. Corporate America's latest no-no is something called stock option backdating. The first criminal trial on that count is set to go to a jury in San Francisco. Former Brocade Communications CEO Greg Reyes is on trial for fudging the books over the timing of options grants. Commentator Jesse Fried says there's a better way to give executives incentive pay.
Many CEOs get rich off stock options, even when investors fare poorly. Boards could easily solve this problem, but executives like things the way they are. And boards are too timid to insist options be structured properly. Here's one big defect in option pay. CEOs get far too much control over when options are granted and when they're cashed out. Thanks to executives' influence over option grant dates, we've had widespread backdating, the falsifying of grant dates to fatten the option kitty, and springloading, CEOs getting options right before good news is announced, giving them a built-in gain. At the back end, boards let CEOs choose when to cash out their options, so they can use inside information to exercise their options and dump the stock ahead of bad news. This lets them make billions of dollars a year in insider trading profits, while shareholders are left holding the bag. It's not hard to eliminate CEOs' influence over when options are given and unwound, but no company has done so, until now. This spring, just as a swell of news about backdating was subsiding, a Colorado-based company, Level 3 Communications, announced a plan that I call hands-off options. It's the brainchild of the Frederick Cook consulting firm. This investor-friendly plan is really quite simple. First, options are issued in 12 equal monthly installments. The schedule is announced far in advance. This makes option grant date manipulation, like backdating and springloading, impossible. Second, each option installment is cashed out automatically at a fixed date several years later. That means Level 3 managers can't profit at the back end by using inside information to time their option exercises and stock sales. At long last, one board is finally prying executives' hands off the options cookie jar. Will other companies rush to follow Level 3's example? Don't hold your breath. Boards eagerly embrace new pay practices that provide sweet deals for CEOs, but they are very reluctant to tie pay more tightly to performance.
Jesse Fried is a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. His book about executive compensation is called Pay Without Performance. You can share your comments with us through our website. It's marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. The Golden State Mutual Life Insurance Company opened up shop here in Los Angeles in 1925. It built a booming business selling insurance to African Americans. It also built one of the most important collections of African American art in the country. Things have been slow for Golden State for a while now, so it's hoping to raise money by selling off part of that collection. In straight dollar terms, it's a small sale for an art world used to $50 million Picassos, but it could have an impact much larger than its hammer price. From KPCC, Adolfo Guzman Lopez reports.
For decades, Golden State Mutual proudly showcased its collection of paintings, drawings, and sculptures at its Los Angeles corporate offices. Now, the collection's most valuable works hang on the walls of Swan Auction Galleries in Manhattan. Nigel Freeman will be overseeing the auction. He stands next to Golden State's signature piece, a 5-foot by 4-foot ink drawing of Harriet Tubman, made in 1965 by Charles White.
He's really one of the best figurative artists in the United States in the 20th century. I mean, not just as an African-American. He's a master draftsman, and his figures are very powerful. He really represented the experience of African-Americans.
This drawing's expected to sell for $250,000 or more. Freeman says Charles White, like many other accomplished black artists, aren't commanding the prices they should be in today's booming art market. Those artists include sculptor Elizabeth Catlett and painter Jacob Lawrence. They're both in the upcoming auction. Longtime Los Angeles art dealer Charlotte Sherman says this auction should help raise the profile and the value of African-American art.
Hopefully, many of the pieces will be acquired by museums and public institutions, and if not, the collectors will permit those works to circulate.
Sherman's gallery has sold art by black artists to comedian Bill Cosby and actor Angela Bassett, among others. She says there's a buzz building around the upcoming auction, and many of her clients have told her they plan on seeing the gavel come down at the New York auction. But Paul Von Blum, a historian of African-American art at UCLA, says it's a shame to break up Golden State's collection. He says the collection tells the story of African-Americans, and that cultural value is more important than the auction price of the individual works.
To have them dispersed not only deprives my students and community groups from seeing that, but it really says that economic priorities trump any kind of cultural vitality.
81-year-old William Pajot worked as Golden State Mutual's art director for 30 years. He put the extraordinary collection together by befriending artists and sometimes bartering one piece for another. Pajot says he hates to see the work separated and hopes buyers will honor the spirit of the collection.
Take care of the work and take care of the concept of the people. If, for instance, you are able to get your hands on a piece of that work, any of it, realize that all of it was put together in love for you and anybody else in the world to see.
Swan Auction Gallery says the collection's expected to fetch about $2 million. In Los Angeles, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez for Marketplace.
We have pictures of some of the art from the Golden State Collection on our website. It's marketplace.org. Time to check the week on Wall Street with arguably the most unpopular man down in Dallas, Texas today, David Johnson. How are you?
Thanks. Yeah. I would always shoot the messenger.
Well, here's the thing, though. It looked like you guys were trying today. Trying. You gave it up a little bit, and then right at the end, it fell off the table.
Yeah. In fact, the last 15 minutes, I think we lost. We were losing, granted, at the rate of about 10 points a minute for the last 15 minutes. But you know what? I mean, this is exactly what one would have expected. Because here's the deal. You have some genuine fear, you know, set into the marketplace, and it's event-driven. It's just you don't know who's going to go bust, or you're going to wake up Monday morning and the Wall Street Journal is going to have a big story about hedge funds of the world are not going to give money back or whatever. So on Fridays, you just don't want to go long into the weekend. I'm not saying this is going to happen. In fact, it's probably not going to happen. But the traders always lighten up, and they always sell. And so you know you're not going to have an uptick on Friday.
All right. Well, that explains today. Let me ask you about yesterday and some of the things that we just kept hearing over and over and over again. One was this phrase of repricing risk or repricing credit. And it obviously goes to the whole credit squeeze that people think is going on. How much of that is real, and what do you think?
Well, you don't know how much is real. I mean, you know that there's some problems placing debt, and you know that so that what you do, what the market always does, is you go back in history. And I'm telling you, the date that kept coming up this week, and it started about Wednesday, what I started thinking about was Friday the 13th, October 1989.
Oh, my.
You remember that?
Frankly, no. What happened?
We'd had a period. Well, we were you know, a couple of years off the big one in 1987. But there'd been a lot of buyouts, and everybody was buying out everybody, and it was just wonderful. And you wouldn't sell a rotten stock because you knew the more rotten that stock was, the thing was just going to get snapped up at some big premium. And the deals. Does this sound familiar? And the deals were going on and on and on and on and on. And all of a sudden, there was one big deal, and it was United Airlines. United Airlines was going to get bought out for, I don't know, some ridiculous amount of money. And they came out and they said, we're not going to do the deal because, in essence, we can't place the debt. Nobody will take the debt. And that's the day the music died.
All right. Well, now, hold
that
on
was
a
the
minute.
No, and instantly, everything fell apart and all the deals and everybody said nobody else is going to. So that's what started happening when you started hearing, you know, they can't place the debt for the Chrysler deal. This Coburg Kravis Roberts deal on boots is going to turkey up.
All right, but hold on, because unless I miss my guess, we haven't had a big deal like the United deal in 89 unwinding yet. I mean, Cerberus is still going ahead because the banks are going to hold on to that debt.
See, that's right, and that's why you're exactly right, and that's the folly of this, but I'm telling you, that's what they're factoring in. Plus, I don't know if you noticed this, we were at historic highs in the market, and sometimes you get a little vulnerable up there.
I always feel vulnerable when I talk to you. You know that?
I'm going to go whistle now that I'm walking
All right.
through this graveyard.
You go do that
here.
Thing. David Johnson on a very weird Friday. He's down in Dallas, Texas. David, thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. We'll see you coming up. You finished the virtual chores in a virtual home. Now, what can you buy with all that fake cash?
Two coffee tables, purple and blue, a stove with a teapot on it, two lamps, blue and pink, and basically a fish.
All right, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials plummeted 208 points today, 1.5%, limping it at 13,265. The NASDAQ fell 37 points, 1.4%, to end at 2562. The S&P 500 slid 23 points, about 1.5%, to 1458. For the week, the Dow tumbled 4.2%. The S&P dropped nearly 5%. The NASDAQ lost 4.7%. Cadbury Schweppes extended the deadline for bids for its U.S. unit. It makes Snapple and Dr. Pepper. Its stock fizzled more than 0.5%. As we mentioned earlier, Blackstone's been taking it on the chin. Today, shares took nearly a 5.5% hit. Shares of Exxon and Chevron fell more than 2.5%. If misery loves company, U.S. traders had plenty of it. Overseas, Tokyo's Nikkei fell 2.3%. London's FTSE and the Paris CAC 40 both fell about 0.5%. The DAX in Frankfurt fell nearly 1%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Marketplace is podcasting. Marketplace Takeout is a mix of our best stories from the past week, the cream of the crop from our reporters around the world, delivered to you on the go wherever you are. Want to sign up? Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link at the top of the page. Or you can download entire shows of Marketplace and Marketplace Money at audible.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at the events for Monday. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Robert Gates meet with Gulf leaders in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, to ask for support in stabilizing Iraq. The American Iron and Steel Institute releases a study on the growth of the Chinese steel industry. And on this day in 2002, Lisa Leslie of the Los Angeles Sparks became the first woman to dunk in a professional basketball game. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a big banking deal in the works, which, if it wasn't worth almost $100 billion, would be tempting to skip over, because banking deals aren't always the sexiest thing in the world, you know. London-based Barclays has gotten itself in a bidding war with the Bank of Scotland over the Dutch group ABN AMRO. There have been the usual offers and counteroffers, but things took an unusual turn this week when Barclays announced it had a new partner with very deep pockets. It's the Chinese government. Some Brits find the prospect of Beijing having a stake in one of the UK's biggest banks a net positive. Others, well, they don't. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
With China set to buy a $13 billion stake in Barclays, the smart money is on the British bank to win this long-running battle. The rival bidder, a consortium led by the Royal Bank of Scotland, may have been outmaneuvered. And Barclays could benefit in other ways, says fund manager Nicola Horlick.
In return, they're going to have access to the Chinese market, which is obviously a big prize, so you can understand that they would want to do a deal like that.
And why the Chinese have been offered a seat on the Barclays board, even though they'll own a stake of less than 10%. For the Chinese, it's an even sweeter deal, according to John Willman, business editor of the Financial Times.
I think the Chinese see something rather interesting in this relationship. I mean, clearly it gets them in on the ground floor of the largest bank merger in history.
He says it will help them diversify some of their $1.2 trillion worth of reserves out of the ever-depreciating US dollar. And for the Chinese, there's an even more important prize.
I think they also are aware that as China opens up to the world, it needs the sort of expertise that they could learn from someone like Barclays.
For all the huge strides that China has made in manufacturing, the country still lags way behind the West in banking know-how, says Duncan Ennis-Kerr of the Economist Intelligence Unit.
Looking at the sector as a whole, it still suffers from a tremendous shortage of skilled and informed personnel. The IT side of it needs a lot more development. Risk management is still in the early stages of being developed to international standards.
But 10 years ago, the Chinese also lagged way behind the West in manufacturing. Now look at them. There's every possibility, says Ennis-Kerr, that in a few years the Chinese could become financiers to reckon with. Shanghai and Hong Kong could together begin to rival New York and London.
The improvement rate is very rapid, so in the future there is no doubt that they will be competing at the highest level, but it will take several years to happen.
The Chinese stake in Barclays is not their first foray into the heart of the Western financial system. Only a few weeks ago, they snapped up a piece of what the communist government in Beijing would in the old days have called a running dog of capitalism. They bought a large stake in the US private equity firm Blackstone. Now, with a piece of Barclays under their belt, this is beginning to look like a shopping expedition, says the FT's John Willman.
So you can almost see them with a shopping list saying it would be good to have a stake in this bit of the banking sector, private equity, tick, there's Blackstone, wholesale banking, tick, there's Barclays. Oh, and Barclays can also help us raise all sorts of debt finance. That's another tick.
He believes that China is quietly embarking on an equity spending spree. No longer happy to plough its massive cash surpluses into treasury bonds, it wants a big share of Western businesses and their profits. It has the money to buy them, and very soon it'll have all the necessary financial expertise as well. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
One stock that didn't hit the skids on today's continued sell-off was the Colorado-based shoemaker Crocs, supplier of those colorful rubber shoes with the holes on the top. Shares spiked almost 10% after yesterday's announcement that second-quarter earnings more than tripled. The Crocs craze has already outlasted most analysts' projections and arguably the boundaries of footwear fashion. And Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports it could be tricky for the shoe company to keep up the pace.
The fact that celebrity chef Mario Batali owns about 50 pairs of these infamously ugly rubber shoes says a lot about Crocs' success. They're cheap and they're comfortable, and they come in so many different colors that many consumers don't stop at one pair. But with new knockoffs hitting the market every month, it's not Crocs' unique styling that's tripling the company's bottom line.
What the product really is the material that they use to make the shoe, which is extremely comfortable.
Jeff Mintz is an analyst with Wedbush Morgan. He says like Coca-Cola, Crocs' success lies in its secret formula for a resin material called Croslite. It's lightweight, odor-resistant, and has so far defied attempts to replicate it.
So it's a combination of not knowing exactly what's in it or in what proportions, and then what the formulation process is.
Min says Crocs' low price tag has enabled it to expand globally. He says sales are up 900% in Europe, and a new plant in Brazil will soon be churning out Crocs for the masses in South America. Call it a global phenomenon, but it's still a niche. And that's where the key to Crocs' future lies. The company plans to diversify by launching an apparel line. NPD Group's Marshall Cohen says that will be the true test.
We've seen
hundreds and hundreds of companies come from a niche product market, try to expand outside of their sweet spot, and really just not quite capture the same love that the consumers had for the original product.
Especially if the clothes look anything like the shoes. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Social networking sites, places like MySpace and Facebook, are used for all kinds of different things. College kids use them for everything from dating to just making friends. Struggling musicians put their songs up, hoping to get noticed. Presidential candidates are there. 10-year-old girls, though, don't want to do any of that stuff, as Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports.
You can thank March of the Penguins for making a pop culture phenomenon of the tuxedo-clad bird. You can thank Club Penguin for taking the craze to a new level.
What is Club Penguin?
Well, it's basically a virtual world.
That's Grace Lansky. She's almost 9 years old. Pretty much every day, she and millions of other kids her age log on and navigate their penguin avatars around a virtual world of igloos. A big part of the fun of Club Penguin isn't just that your friends are on it. It's that you earn virtual money by doing virtual chores so you can go virtual shopping.
Tell me more about what I'm seeing in your igloo, because obviously people can't see what we're looking at right now.
Two coffee tables, purple and blue. A stove with a teapot on it. Two lamps, blue and pink. And basically a fish.
How did you get it all?
I bought it.
Now, while the alluring subtext of this virtual world is that you get to consume just like a grown-up, the people behind the site are dead set against ads. Instead, they make their money because kids pay to be a member, or rather, their parents pay about $6 a month. Club Penguin officials won't say how many subscribers they have or how much money they make, but word in the trades is that big media companies have been looking to buy this little startup Canadian company for something like $500 million. So eager are they to get their hands on this devoted audience of young consumers.
It is a cliche, but that's the power of the internet.
Rafat Ali covers the phenomenon of social networking on his blog, Paid Content.
Especially with kids, things catch on like wildfire. If one kid is doing it in his or her school, everybody has to do it. And that's why the market is so lucrative and it grows so fast.
And why so many people are jumping into the social networking game, hoping to find the next big thing. Because once they age out of Club Penguin, Grace and her friends will be looking for somewhere else to hang out online. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, just something to bear in mind next time you empty your change jar. The most expensive dime in history just flew first class from San Jose to New York City. The 1894 Liberty dime was sold for $1.9 million this week. It made the trip with a coin dealer who stuck it in his pocket for the ride. To be fair, we ought to say the guy mentioned he didn't get a wink of sleep on that red-eye flight he was taking. The New York-based buyer has decided he would rather remain anonymous. And that is Marketplace on this Friday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow sank 208 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ fell 37 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 dropped 23 points. That is 1.6% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. On Monday, slowing down the revolving door on high-tech workers.
These are folks who are coming here to do a job, have fun, while they can in the United States, and then use this experience in different parts of the world.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.